6, State of Minnesota versus Todd Clifford Bowlby. These arguments are being held by Zoom, and they are also being live streamed. There is a recording of this proceeding, and all parties will have access to that within the next few days. However, no other recording is permitted of this proceeding without prior court permission. Attorneys for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. There is a clock in the square to so be aware of the time so you stay within your allotted time limit. If there is if any party encounters any technical difficulties, we will make sure that we take appropriate steps to make sure that we address those issues, and you do have your allotted time. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin and proceed. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is James Doty. I'm an assistant Mohawk County attorney on behalf of appellant, State of Minnesota, in this matter. Briefly, this is an appeal from the district court's pretrial order, which dismissed two counts of a 5-count criminal complaint, both relevant counts related to HRO violation. The dismissal was in response to the respondent's motion to dismiss counts 1 and 2 for lack of probable cause, which argued that the evidence presented to the district court at omnibus did not show that respondent possessed the requisite mens rea of the dismissed offenses. The state appellant at this time is asking that this court reverse the district court's contested omnibus order, reinstate the dismissed counts. Again, that's counts 1 and 2 of the criminal complaint, and further to remand the matter back to the district court for further proceedings. The appellant's argument at present is essentially relegated to 3 prongs. First, the district court erroneously concluded that a conviction for violating an HRO required evidence that the respondent intended to harass the protected party. Prong 2 of the argument is that the district court also erred by engaging in a sua sponte inquiry into the underlying HRO civil court file that gave rise to the HRO's issuance, and concluding that any subsequent filings in that matter negated the mens rea requirement in the criminal matter. Finally, the third prong, the final prong, is that the district court erred by collaterally attacking the HRO and finding that its issuance was, so to speak, unfair or unjust. With regard to the first prong regarding the harassment requirement, the statutory mens rea requirement is essentially non-existent in 609.748. State versus Anderson, an opinion of this court, held that the statute was not simply a strict liability offense. It required the state to prove that a defendant's presence in a particular location would subject him to criminal liability. Now, although State v. Anderson is authoritative in the sense of its mens rea requirement, it's factually distinguishable from the present matter in State versus Anderson. That defendant was subject to an HRO that had a similar geographic prohibition. Cannot recall the exact length, but it prevented that defendant from being within a certain number of feet of that protected party's residence. The address of the residence was listed on the HRO as confidential. In essence, the defendant was not on notice of where he could not be, and in effect could theoretically accidentally violate the HRO. That's not the case here. The HRO giving rise to the present violation and part of the record at the district court indicated that the particular location that the respondent was prohibited from being within 250 feet of was a gas station in Isle, Minnesota, Johnson's Portside. It included the full address, city, state, and zip code of that location. The district court erred in this regard by concluding, quote, no evidence has been presented to show that defendant's respondent initiated any contact with the petitioning party at any time or was repeatedly present within the restricted area. So in sum, the district court held contact with the individuals themselves was required and or repeated presence or contacts. Now it's this appellant's position, neither are required to sustain a conviction under 609.748, and importantly, neither are elements in the relevant jury instruction guides. And this is applicable to the related unpublished decision contained in the appellant's brief, State versus Boyd, It's an unpublished case, coincidentally also out of the Mille Lacs County District Court, where this court in that matter concluded that essentially what the appellant is arguing the court should conclude now, which is that, quote, Boyd argues that she could have only violated the HRO if she committed repeated incidents of harassment. This argument is unavailing because it relies on the statutory definition of harassment for purposes of issuing an HRO.
So, counsel, you're asking us to reverse and remand and to have the HRO charges reinstated. Do the district court's findings of fact, are they sufficient to conclude that there was probable cause to support those charges? In other words, that the knowledge requirement, mens rea requirement from Anderson is met?
Thank you, Your Honor. My position is that the court did issue those facts sufficient. It's argued in the sort of the third prong of it, of the argument, but essentially the district court did find that the HRO was active, that the defendant was, or that respondent was served with a copy of that HRO, that he was within, in this matter, it's 100 feet, the HRO prohibited 250, but the evidence in the district court found he was within 100 feet of the excluded address. And so essentially there's the knowledge requirement in the sense that it specifically found the defendant was given the name of the gas station and the address of it, that he was present in that location within the 250 feet and that the order was active and that he knew of it. So it's
counsel, I just want to build on the question that Judge Cochran asked. I'm just want to try to seek a little bit of clarification of what exactly you are asking for in terms of your relief. And I understand you're asking for us to reverse and remand, but are you asking us to reverse and remand for the district court to make a final determination on the probable cause issue, or are you asking us to reverse and remand and basically tell the district court that it erred by not finding probable cause and that it should determine that there is indeed probable cause based on its own findings of fact?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe I understand the question, and I'm inclined to lean more toward the latter at the present moment. I think that the core facts that have been found were not, and this is present in both parties' briefs, that the core facts were not really in contest. The court did not hear conflicting evidence or conflicting facts. It found essential facts that are necessary to find probable cause for the underlying offense. Now, with regard to the order itself, the order in the appellant's position sort of strayed beyond that and went more into sort of a, you know, an interest of justice and argument and equity about the fairness of the proceeding, the fairness of the underlying HRO. And to my understanding, at this point, an instruction to the district court that it's finding that there's some sort of unfairness or unfitness of the original HRO, that would be sufficient. With regard to, and then that's particularly important with regard to prong two of the argument, because the district court, in furtherance of its sort of argument, or rather findings in equity, was that the district court did also err by engaging into sort of a sua sponte investigation to the underlying civil court file. It's important to note that no parties presented evidence from the underlying civil court file, save for the original petition, HRO, proof of service, things of that nature. What the district court in part relied on in issuing this order was a subsequent pleading that the respondent filed in that civil matter. The state was unaware of it. I don't believe it was argued by his counsel to be relevant, that essentially the court applied sort of an ex post facto analysis that this later pleading that was not before the district court somehow could go back after the matter was charged to negate his mens rea at the time of the offense. It's erroneous. And as I indicate in the brief, it violates the party presentation principle. This is not something that was presented for the district court to resolve one way or the other.
Let's say that we agree with you on that, on this point, and say the district court erred in doing its own investigation. What relief do you get off that?
The relief would go more toward the finding of the lack of mens rea requirement, meaning that The case law at present, and this is an important note, the state, I have not key cited this particular statute and read every single published or unpublished case that cites it, but in my thorough review of it, I've not found a case that dealt with the district court doing what the district court did in this occasion, which is itself collaterally attacking an HRO and finding it to be unfair or...
Well, that's the third point, is the collateral attack. I'm focused on the investigation piece. Finding evidence in the civil file, it seems to me that if we agree with you on that point, it's a remand to do an analysis without including that other material.
Thank you, Your Honor. And yes, I would agree that with regard to the second prong, yes, essentially the remedy in case law relates mainly to the defendant finding structural error. That's not a standard. I don't believe it has been applied to the state. That's not what the appellate's asking in this regard. Just with regard to a potential remand, that evidence, that subsequent pleading can't be, or any other pleading that wasn't part of the record before the district court, can be considered when determining the mens rea requirement, element, I should say, and whether the remaining evidence before the district court presented by the parties can support the mens rea requirement. And with regard to the third prong of the state's argument is essentially, I've made reference to this collateral attack. It's prevalent throughout the majority of the order. However, this is really where the district court applied a standard that just simply can not only bar this prosecution, but theoretically any prosecution related to this underlying HRO. The district court found that the judicial, I'll just quote it, there is no indication the judicial officer had any awareness of the practical consequence of the decision to include the 250-foot distance requirement from the petitioning party's job site. Further, unquote, further in the order, it states, quote, it is probable that had the reviewing judge known the public highway municipal airport location, the reviewing judge may not have included a distance requirement, but would have limited the order to what was requested by the petitioning party or excluded Highway 47 and the Isle Airport from the distance requirement. So in sum, not only is that, unquote, sorry, in sum, essentially, not only is this a reversible error in terms of the present matter, it's sort of a categorical bar to any further prosecution. It's sort of a criminal court files reversal of a civil court files HRO issuance. It's entirely improper. The case law has specifically stated that a collateral attack for a later prosecution for violating it on the original HRO is simply not proper. And that also relates to the State v. Boyd case that I mentioned earlier. There are avenues in an HRO civil court file to challenge things like geographic distance requirements. There's motions for reconsideration. There's motions to modify. There's even an appeal to this court. There's a specific appellate period by which an issuance of an HRO can be attacked or appealed. But the fact of a later violation of the order, the original HRO's issuance, is simply off the table for contest. The defendant cannot say, well, I can violate this HRO because the original HRO existing, active, and to my knowledge, in effect, is unfair.
Also, one of the things that the district court did say is that the issue of the distance, the 200-foot distance requirement, had not been raised by either party. So the district court sua sponte came up with that number. Why is the district court in this matter wrong in saying the prior district court made a mistake because it decided an issue that was not even properly before it?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's the appellant's position, that the district court made a mistake insofar as it amounts to a flaw in the district court's opinion with the reasonableness of the original underlying HRO, which in a further prosecution for a violation of the HRO is barred. There's the brief contains plenty of case law. Collateral attack, no matter if it's on a geographic restriction, no matter if it's on a digital telephonic restriction, things of that nature, there are remedies for the parties in that underlying civil court file to challenge, take issue with, or raise. But the fact that the judicial officer in this case and the underlying HRO file, sua sponte, added a 250-foot distance requirement, it's, again, State versus Anderson, there's a footnote in there that expressly authorizes a district court to include a reasonable distance requirement. And further, those distance requirements often do include public streets. For example, cited is the decision, it is the unpublished decision of State versus Harrington that had to do with anti-abortion protesting that had happened on the sidewalk and street in front of a protected party's residence. There's a distance requirement in that case that was found to be proper and that it was found that the defendants had violated. The fact that it includes more than just the four corners of the residence, or in this case, workplace, in question does not foreclose the judicial officer from issuing a distance requirement or prosecuting authority from prosecuting a violation of that district requirement or distance requirement, rather. Further, I will just very briefly conclude here. The state is requesting that the appellant is requesting that this court reverse or remand for further proceedings to reinstate counts one and two. And further, as I noted, that the district court did find all facts necessary to sustain certainly probable cause, but should the state prove those facts beyond a reasonable doubt, a conviction in the matter. Thank you. I recognize my time is up and I can take any other questions.
I don't see any other questions at this time. Thank you, counsel. We will now turn over to counsel for respondent. You will have 15 minutes. The clock is set for you. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am the attorney for respondent, Mr. Bowlby. My name is Madison Bruber. And today I'm asking the court to consider upholding the district court's order, basically denying probable cause in the state's first and second count in its complaint. Really, the court's order, I think, basically boils down to intent, whether or not Mr. Bowlby had intent to violate the district court's HRO order.
But counsel, is intent a requirement, or is it just knowledge of the HRO and its terms?
I would argue intent. It's
what case law support, because Anderson doesn't talk about intent. Anderson talks about knowledge. And in that case, the issue was the appellant there did not know of the location. So the distance was immaterial. The appellant had no knowledge.
It's knowing all facts that make your actions criminal, basically. So I would argue that Mr. Bowlby was not aware of the total distance requirements between Johnson's port side and where entering the municipal airport actually got him in trouble. Through the district court's order.
What support do you have for that you didn't know the distance requirements? Because the district court found that he was served with the HRO and that the location was within 100 feet and they were, I think the court said, adjacent to each other. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but why aren't those facts sufficient to show knowledge? And you know, what other facts would you have us look at to suggest that he didn't have knowledge?
I think the district court's order talks a lot about Mr. Bowlby's actions, how he was genuinely surprised by being stopped by law enforcement when talked about violating the HRO, didn't know that he couldn't go to the airport or cross highway 47, things like that. And I think that's also why the district court goes into kind of its talk about how court sua sponte putting on distance requirements affect people, especially in smaller towns, being able to access things like gas stations, airports, basically main roads. And I know the state took a little bit of offense to the district court kind of plotting out, I'm assuming using Google Maps or Apple Maps to figure out the different distance locations between these things. But when you're living in a small town and all of a sudden you have petitioners not asking for distance requirements from certain things, and then judges just slapping them on and deciding what's appropriate, but not realizing how close things are to each other.
Counsel, if I could just stop you there, because you said the state takes offense of the district court apparently engaging in extra record and investigation. I mean, the rules of judicial conduct are pretty clear. We are limited to the record before us, both on appeal and the district court. So, I mean, just speaking for myself, it's a little disconcerting to see that there may be one, if not two, instances of the district court, like you said, maybe using Google Maps. I mean, was that evidence before the district court?
I will say I talked about the distance in my brief to the court.
Between appellant's house, or I'm sorry, respondent's house and
I didn't talk about the house, but
okay,
the
because the
house.
district court talked about the ho his house.
I did
I didn't
not talk
see
about.
anything there.
Yep, I did not talk about the house, and I guess I cannot speak to whatever the district court. And I think I put this in my brief to the appellate court. I can't speak to whatever the court heard or spoke to whoever in the courthouse about whatever Mr. Bowlby did after seeking a modification. I know nothing about that. That was not in the record. I do concede that point.
In your brief, I think you mentioned that, it's, I don't want to misstate what you said, but you made some reference to it might, that it's common for judges to look at civil files and CHIPS files. I'm not aware that that is permissible under the Code of Judicial Conduct or the case law. I think the case law says that you have to decide the cases on the facts before you. And if you are relying on facts from another case that hasn't been presented by either party, I think there's a real concern there about going outside of the record. So do you have some case law that you can point us to that suggests that it's appropriate for a judge in a criminal case to look at a civil file matter without that where those documents haven't been filed in that criminal matter?
I guess I don't have a case. I've seen it in certain court orders, though.
Well, and maybe that's true that you've seen it, but I don't know that that makes it appropriate or that it's good practice.
I would agree with that. I just know I have seen it. So I whatever but again, I it's harder it I do have to concede the point. I can't really say that it was great in this court order for there to be outside investigation or outside research to be done within these facts. That's something that has gone beyond the record, and it's not something I can really address. I have seen it done in practice before, where especially in smaller counties, judges just happen to know what's going on because they preside over, a number of cases, and that filters in. I do agree that judges need to be impartial in every case that they hear, and they need to take the facts that are only on the record. How much this actually affects overall, the district court's order, I don't know. I would say there is definitely facts in the record, though, that support the fact that there wasn't a request for 200 feet, and then the district court sua sponte put in 200 feet, barring Mr. Bowlby from basically being that close to Johnson's port side.
And
So
I had a question on that point. Isn't the remedy to on the distance restriction, isn't the remedy to go challenge that in the HRO civil file or to appeal to our court and say, nobody asked for this and this was sua sponte put in there. You should limit it to 50 feet or some other restriction.
absolutely. And I think that's great. However, when we're dealing with normally HROs that are filed like this, these are pro se clients that don't understand really the ability to do those things. I get that the court wants to and the state wants to talk about the different abilities to modify HROs, but I'll be honest, Mr. Bowlby is a public defender client. He doesn't have the resources and means to go out and hire someone like that.
You
So
don't dispute, though, that he was served with the HRO and the HRO includes the 250-foot restriction.
no, I do not dispute that.
And the question before the district court was probable cause, which is a relatively low standard.
That's correct.
And counsel, first of all, I just want to thank you for your candor. I appreciate that. But and follow up on what Judge Cochran was, the district court also said that the HR not only was served on respondent, but it, quote, placed him on notice, quote, placed him on notice, end quote, that it prohibited him from being within 250 feet of the petitioner's job site.
That is what it says.
Okay. And yep. And that he was also, the HR also put him on notice that any conduct could, in violation of the, any of the specific provisions of the order, would constitute a violation of the HRO, right?
Yes.
So if he was put on notice, isn't that enough for the knowledge requirement to in terms of the elements of a violation of an HRO?
I guess, again, I would argue no. Really what we're talking about, and I think this is also mentioned in the district court's order, and I get there's a difference between harassment and just conduct, any conduct. And I don't think necessarily the district court's order is saying that harassment is necessary for there to be a violation. But I think conduct with the party, there needs to be more than just a general passing by, in the sense where there's a traveling not towards that person.
Right. Well, counsel, actually, I'm glad you brought up the traveling past, because the district court in its findings of fact number 7 acknowledged that the officers located him at Isle Airport. And so are you disputing any of the findings of fact by the district court?
I'm not.
Okay. Because then later, the district court, in its conclusions of law, says that he was just passing, that he was just basically passing by, driving on the highway, which contradicts its prior finding of fact.
I think it was passing by on the highway to turn into the Isle Airport. It was known that Mr. Bowlby, and I think it was said, I think it was in the findings of fact, that Mr. Bowlby is known to go to the Isle Airport to volunteer and do work there. So he was traveling by on the highway, which leads to the municipal airport. So he was.
I thought he went there to go fishing, because didn't he have his boat and a trailer?
I think that was hooked up to his car. He wasn't going there to go fishing. He goes there to work.
Oh, okay. But the district court, in its conclusions of law, said that his presence was only transitory, but he actually stopped there, correct?
The presence, so he would have stopped basically prior outside of the 250 feet. So he was transitory basically on that, within that distance restriction. So the Isle Airport
driveway in is within the district distance restriction, but if he kept going and stopped, that would have been outside of the 250 feet. Is that what you're suggesting?
Correct.
Thank you.
Yep. So the turn in is within the distance restriction.
So the way I read the district court order, it seems like it's adding two requirements to a violation by simply being within the 250 feet. It seems to add a contact requirement and repeatedly being present there. But that's not part of the HRO condition that is alleged to have been violated, correct?
Correct. I don't see the repeated part. And I would note a lot of what the state has brought up, especially in Boyd with the multiple harassment, is not here. And I agree, multiple harassment isn't needed. It's only one instance that is needed of that conduct. But a lot of what, especially the state brings up in, I think it's State versus Everson, State versus Wood, there has been direct contact with those protected people, in saying that you can't basically attack the collateral HRO or argue the distance requirements or anything like that. It's basically people blatantly violating the HRO, and that includes Boyd as well. This you don't have. This you have just someone passing by, albeit within that distance requirement, but not for the sake of violating that HRO, just for the sake of going about their daily business. And especially in somewhere where you can't do anything.
So, but in the district court's order, it seems focused on harassment. I mean, its conclusion is paragraph 15 says defendant's one-time incidental contact with Johnson's port side is not harassment. And then a review of the entire record does not show it is more probable than not than that defendant has committed a crime. And then in the paragraph before, it talks about harassing behavior and distinguish talking about the Pappas case. So the court really does seem to be focused on harassment and not just whether his violation was a knowing violation of the terms of the HRO, at least in my reading of it, when you look at the analysis that leads to its conclusion.
I understand that. And I think it, again, it goes back to, I think, the court trying to focus on showing that there wasn't a knowing violation of it because there wasn't this criminal action coming in from behind it. There wasn't this intent to seek out the people at Johnson's port side or this intent to,
But do you need intent to seek out the people at Johnson's port side to violate the HRO when the HRO prohibits being within a certain distance?
I mean, I think again, it comes down to that knowledge point, and I apologize. I am out of time, but if you would like me to finish answering the question, I will.
You may answer the question.
Thank you. I think it comes down again. I know that there's that knowledge requirement, and it's more understanding the actions behind it and not knowing that just the transitory going past it to enter a place where he was allowed to be would in fact violate the HRO.
Thank you, counsel. I don't see any other questions. So we will now turn over to appellant. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, by way of rebuttal, it was discussed that the 250-foot restriction was a sua sponte restriction, and the knowledge of the issuing judge in sort of a small county. The appellant would rebut to that by saying that it is true that the original petition for the HRO, along with the corresponding HRO that had issued, were both in the record before the district court as part of these proceedings. So, with regard to the state's second prong argument about sua sponte inquiry, the fact that the original issuing HRO judge provided the 250-foot requirement being sua sponte, that's not the product of this district court engaging in a sua sponte investigation. It was in the record that that was not requested by the petitioning party. It's still the appellant's position that that is entirely irrelevant because it is sort of still a valid term of the order, whether it was requested or not. And further, the fact that it would prohibit access to, as counsel in the district court described, gas stations, grocery stores, the like, those are entirely fair arguments to make at the civil HRO court file in terms of whether or not to reconsider that restriction. A later attack, I would argue, in inequity against the validity of that term is not permissible. And in fact, actually, there's been case law cited in the brief. One of the unpublished decisions itself, I believe this was State versus Harrington, found that, excuse me, State versus Wood found that an attack in a criminal violation matter against the court's statutory authority to issue a geographic restriction. In that case, it was 300 feet. An attack after the fact that the district court didn't have statutory authority to do something, let alone was right or fair or just to do it, but even statutory authority has been rejected by this court as an argument against finding that the defendant had violated the term of the order. And then finally, I'll just respond to the point about it was raised in the district court as this is some kind of transitory contact or presence, I think was the term. This more than just passing by argument, appellant respectfully differs. That is not something that needs to be shown at the criminal stage of the proceedings. Both State versus Harrington and State versus Iverson dealt with regard to Harrington, as I described, with a line of protesters coming across a residential street. And then with Iverson, it was an individual in their car on the road driving, turning around and driving back. So technically repeated once, but in a sense, it's the state's argument, even that first time he drove by, that's a violation. So the fact that the conduct was somehow quick or transitory or non-threatening, it's still that person's presence in a prohibited area, and accordingly, it's still a violation. And I know I have significant time left, but that's all I have to rebut, and I'm happy to take questions.
Counsel, I do have, I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
No, you go ahead, sorry.
I just have a quick question on the district court's conclusion of law number 12. At the very end, it says the prosecution and defendant under these specific facts violates the Minnesota state constitution and refers to the right to remain silent and due process. What, if anything, do you make of that?
Your Honor, I will note that the constitutional challenge, there was no constitutional challenge raised by defendant in this matter. It was purely probable cause. I believe in that matter, it relates to another paragraph of the order discussing the fact that at the actual HRO proceeding, it's the consequence of issuing it without the benefit of testimony, I believe is the phrase that was used. Meaning, in a sense, the underlying proceeding which gave rise to the HRO was one without, as the district court found, the benefit of testimony. I believe it had originally been an ex parte order, so I think that could be part of it. But with regard to the constitutional finding of due process and the right to remain silent, no one's forced this defendant to testify in this matter, so I'm not sure what else I could relate to.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I wanted to follow up on respondent's argument that the evidence shows that Mr. Bowlby was genuinely surprised when the officers told him he was in violation of the HRO, and there's other evidence to suggest that he didn't intend to violate the HRO or didn't have knowledge sufficient to violate the HRO. Can you respond to that argument?
I would, in a couple of forms, so I would be very brief, mindful of my time being out. I can't surmise as to why a person would or would not be surprised. I would agree with counsel's characterization of the record, including that this is a sort of a moving target where a person was moving in a vehicle and turning. What the surprise could be there, I'm not sure. With regard to Your Honor's later point about not having intent to violate, I think that's been discussed, and it's discussed in the state's brief. It's the knowledge and intent requirement leading into one another as they may, a requirement that a defendant fully aware of an HRO intending to drive by this location in a conscious sort of effort, a specific intent effort to violate it. I don't believe the state of the law requires the state to prove that. Simply, it's just the knowledge requirement by State versus Anderson.
Thank you. It looks like there are no more questions. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing, both very well done. We appreciate it. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe.